impressions of the Robertson panel meeting. A man who I was to know socially quite well later, Fred C. Durant, D-U-R-A-N-T, the third, when I was associate director of the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory in Cambridge, approached me. It was arranged that I was to present myself in Washington before the Robertson panel, along with Captain Ruppelt. And I remember when I first arrived there, being kept waiting in the hall for a while. Fred Durant came out to see me, and he was the very picture of cloak and dagger secrecy, apparently rather young at the time and rather impressed with his own importance of having engineered all this. He was clearly the arrangements man or logistics manager for the panel. I was duly impressed with the solemnity of the occasion. However, my feeling of awe for the top-notch scientists in the room was mixed with a slight feeling of resentment that I, who really knew much more about actual cases, having worked with them since 1948, some 5 years previously, was being regarded as a sort of just witness, and then not even a star witness, in the face of the fact that I recognized that although these men were very top-notch scientists, I clearly was aware of the fact that they knew very much less about the subject than I did, despite the fact that they represented the solid establishment of science. I really don't know why I should have stood in so much awe of them. After all, in 1953, I was assistant dean of the graduate school at Ohio State University, had published quite a few papers in astronomy by then, and certainly in the field they were addressing themselves to, had far more experience. By that time, I had certainly interrogated a great many witnesses and certainly had read and studied in very great detail many hundreds of reports. And I was 43 years old and certainly should not have been overawed by people like Lloyd Berkner and Gut Smith and Louis Alvarez, even though he later became a Nobel Prize winner. But despite the awe, I still went in the room with a fair amount of resentment in their not recognizing the fact that at the given moment it was what was known about the particular subject under discussion and not the general scientific standing that really counted. When I entered the room, the principal participants were seated around a typical thick conference table, and the whole proceedings were rather formal and rather brusque, I thought. There did not seem to be the weigh and consider attitude that one has been taught to expect of scientists, but rather an offhand dismissal of the cases presented. And as far as the cases presented, they were hardly representative of the many I had read. I could have picked many others that I feel they should have looked at. How the cases were chosen, I don't know, and I don't know whether the cases were chosen as a part of a put-up job to impress them with the idea that they could be explained away or not, and I probably will never know that. It was clear from the start, however, that they were not entertaining any notion of extraterrestrial visitors or any new empirical observations. It was clear that they had come into the room with the very definitely preconceived notion, at least I thought so, that these things just couldn't be, and that unless they were faced with absolutely incontrovertible evidence, which meant charts, graphs, photographs, and unimpeachable witnesses who would at least have to have been PhDs in physics, that they weren't buying. Rather, they were there to sell debunking, or at least I so thought, or it became apparent after a while, certainly. Well, they didn't spend much time in any case. Apparently, they had already been over the cases, and they just wanted to ask some questions, and then they wanted to ask my opinion about the two films they apparently had already shown, and but they showed them again for Captain Ruppelt and me. And the projector was set up on the table, and there was either a white sheet on the wall, or maybe the wall itself was white. At any rate, the pictures projected on the wall were not large. And the first picture shown were the Tremont, Utah case, which they almost immediately dismissed as seagulls, despite the fact that a Navy analysis of those same photographs had shown, at least to the Navy's satisfaction, that these couldn't have been seagulls. And I don't know why, but I sort of went along with them. I couldn't prove otherwise, and I was not in any mood to argue, and the weight of authority rested very much in their hands. In fact, the weight of scientific authority was positively oppressive in the room. One felt that one simply would not really have been able to voice a dissenting opinion and without being mowed down. Then they went on to the Great Falls, Montana case, which, again, I didn't buy the idea that they were jets because it just didn't look like the way jets would reflect. Jets won't reflect that length of time over that large an arc. And, of course, this has been amply proved later by Bob Baker, who made a very excellent analysis of those films. But again, they were in a very definite mood to debunk on the general idea that, well, those couldn't be UFOs, therefore they had to be natural, and the only natural thing they could think of was jets, and so they just had to be jets, period. And I would have had just about as much chance of coming out and saying that I thought they were all wet as Galileo might have had in satisfying or convincing the inquisitors that the earth moved. It just wasn't the order of the day, and that was that. In fact, that just about expresses it. The order of the day was UFOs are natural things, people are silly and deluded, and the data presented that a physicist wants, they gave the impression to me that they wanted impeccable photographs, charts, graphs, names and addresses of the ufonauts, equations, and the proverbial landing on the White House lawn. There was an absolute odor of superciliousness in the room that I felt very sensitive about, because even though I was considered a debunker myself, I felt that the court was not a scientific court. They were jumping to conclusions at a very, very great rate. In short, I wanted the subject to have a fair hearing, and I certainly didn't feel, in fact, there was just no question, that at least during the time I was in their presence, the subject did not have a fair hearing. Now, if the whole Robertson panel was a put-up job, then one could argue that they deliberately chose high scientific establishment men, men who were terribly, terribly busy, could obviously not spend a lot of time examining things, and had no intention of doing their homework, but of simply passing judgment on the basis of their previous scientific experience in and only in their present scientific framework. And it would have been just as difficult to express a different idea as it would have been to have convinced a physicist in the year 1880 that matter and energy were interchangeable. The law said that matter was conserved no matter what, and that was that. And you just don't come around here with this nonsense about matter being changed into energy. I mean, it was that sort of attitude that I sensed all throughout. And then I just don't remember the many questions. Well, not too many at that. In some cases, rather perfunctory questions that were asked. Do I have any outstanding evidence to present to the contrary? I thought I might have had, but in the face of that onslaught, I wasn't about to bring it up. And furthermore, the data at that time were not convincing in the sense that a physicist wants something to be convincing. I was quite sure, and I had made up my mind, although it never eventuated, I had made up my mind quite firmly that I would sign nothing. Fortunately, I was not asked to. And when the report finally came out, that is the recommendations, I was not overly surprised to find the tack they had taken of the general need for debunking. Now, it is true that, now it comes back to mind, it was described during the meetings, the military implications of the flap of 1952, the crowding of the military wires, and so that if some enemy, for instance, had wanted to perpetrate a Pearl Harbor, let's say, all they would have needed to do was to get their agents to spawn a whole bunch of UFO reports at the right time. And it's quite true that the military wires would have been clogged, and one wouldn't have been able to tell a UFO from a missile from a hole in the ground. So I recognized the danger that UFO reports at critical times could, the danger that they could be at critical times. Another way to describe their basic attitude that got under my skin was very clearly an attitude of "Daddy knows best. Don't come to me with these silly stories. I know what's good for you, and don't argue." My experience with the Robertson panel stayed with me, and years later, when I wrote a strong recommendation to the Air Force that a scientific panel should be set up to study the whole situation, and I had specifically said that scientists, although good scientists should be chosen, they should be those who had sufficient time to do their homework and not expect to conduct a scientific investigation in a few days by, you might say, taking a vote on it rather than studying. If I had known or even thought that the UFO problem would still be with us of what went on in the Robertson panel, this was true all throughout, even in my years with Blue Book, I didn't keep the notes or wasn't aware of the politics behind the whole business, as I certainly now realize I should have been. The viewing of the two films is the incident which remains most by far vivid in my mind. The rather informal attitude at the time, the men had left their austere positions around the conference table and were sort of crouching around and leaning over each other's shoulders like that, and the picture was small and the room could not be completely darkened, so we had to look rather closely at the wall, at the pictures being buzzed off, and each picture I think was played at least twice, and there were a whole interplay of comments, not exactly wisecracks, but certainly looks like seagulls to me, and you can't convince me that that's not birds. It's got to be birds, and words to that effect. Some people expressed a little dismay at the pre-modern films that they didn't realize that birds could reflect that much. And someone else said, "Oh yes, they can if the light's right, sun's right." And I believe I mentioned that the change in light was too rapid for to be birds in flight, but that got nowhere. Certainly throughout the whole meetings, I did not feel at all like a colleague of the panel, but rather as one of the witnesses brought in for certain evidence or comments and then dismissed, as a witness would be when he's asked to step down from the chair. Well, I guess that's really all of the impressions I have. It's been nearly 21 years since then. I do remember the room quite vividly. I don't remember the building, but the shape of the room, and particularly the showing of the films on the wall, this I do remember, and also the rather unctuous and self-important bearing of Fred Durant, who was really terribly impressed with his role in this thing, and he would say in very hushed tones that this was a CIA meeting, and in his mind, the letter CIA spelled G-O-D, and that was my introduction to the meeting. And while I was not impressed with their results or in their manner of going about it, in fact, I was rather disappointed and almost disgusted, still, I was really awed by the scientific power or prestige that was represented there.